Hello, I'm Freedom Party leader, Paul McKeever, and for your convenience, I will now read to you Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election platform. Freedom Party of Ontario's election platform is comprised of 18 planks. This audiobook is arranged so that you can listen to each one of them as a separate chapter. And now, without further ado, Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election platform. Eliminating Dalton McGuinty's pesticide ban. In 2009, Dalton McGuinty's Liberals introduced a ban on lawn and garden pesticides. Since that time, ragweed, dandelions, grubs, and a host of other pests have been destroying Ontario lawns. Aphids and other organisms have been destroying gardens. The ban was not imposed because of science, proving that their proper use harms humans. To the contrary, the products banned by the McGuinty government are approved for home use by Health Canada. The ban was imposed anyway. The reason for imposing the ban is as simple as it is irrational. Ontario's Environment Minister explained the reason as follows. Quote, Health Canada never says whether or not a particular product or ingredient is safe. All they say is that there's not an unnecessary risk. What we are concerned about, what all of those in the environmental community are concerned about, is the cumulative effect of all of these various products that have been used on our lawns, our backyards, our front yards, in playgrounds, and in parks. That's what this is all about. Nobody knows exactly what the long-term health effect of these products together is. That's why we're doing it, in order to protect the health and welfare, particularly of our young children that are likely to play on the various lawns and parks of this province. That's who this is all about. It's based on good science. Unquote. That's from the Ontario Legislature Hansard, June 18, 2008. Read that closely. According to the minister, despite all of the, quote, good science, unquote, quote, nobody knows, unquote, what the effects of the pesticides are. In other words, the McGuinty government banned pesticides without any scientific evidence that they are harmful to human health. Why did they do it? To pander to, quote, the environmental community, unquote. The Liberals' pesticide ban is a textbook case of irrational governmental decision-making. Government ought never to ban something for which there is no scientific evidence of harm. Irrational fears of imaginary harm, fears based not on knowing but on ignorance, are not an acceptable basis for imposing bans, fines, or threats of imprisonment on the buyers and sellers of lawn and garden care products approved by Health Canada. It is irrational, wrong, and anti-scientific to ban something until it is proven safe. Almost everything might one day be shown to be harmful if used for certain purposes or in certain quantities and concentrations. That does not mean that it is right for the government to ban almost everything. It is inappropriate for a government to ban something for fear that someone might use it wrongly or in the wrong quantity. One can kill oneself by drinking gasoline, but we would not want the purchase or sale of gasoline to be banned for that reason. Similarly, one can kill oneself by drinking too much water, yet it would be homicidal to ban the drinking of water. Freedom Party opposes the imposition of bans for irrational, unscientific, fear-driven, or vote-buying reasons. A Freedom government will eliminate Dalton McGuinty's 2009 pesticide ban. Ontario will have healthy, beautiful lawns and gardens again. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on Eliminating Dalton McGuinty's Pesticide Ban, Ending Forced Religious Observance. In 1888, a meeting of Baptists, Anglicans, Presbyterians, and Methodists led to the formation of the Lord's Day Alliance of Canada. In 1906, thanks largely to their efforts, a petition with 100,000 signatures was sent to the federal parliament in Ottawa. The result was the passage, in 1907, of new federal legislation called the Lord's Day Act. The Lord's Day Act prohibited the sale of any goods on Sunday. However, no person could be prosecuted under the Act except with the express permission of the Attorney General of the province in which the person was conducting business. So, in the decades after the Lord's Day Act was passed, the Lord's Day Alliance lobbied the government to press charges against various offenders. The Lord's Day Alliance managed to have a man in Cobourg charged for showing a motion picture on a Sunday. On another occasion, the Alliance prevented an international bowling competition from being completed because the final game would have ended 1/2 hour past midnight on a Saturday. In 1953, the City of Toronto declared an 8-day period to be Jerusalem Week. The purpose of the declaration was to assist in the sale of State of Israel bonds. The Alliance immediately objected, saying that the sale of the bonds during that period would break the law twice because the period contained two Sundays. On yet another occasion, the Alliance attempted to have Toronto Market gardeners convicted for tending to their gardens on Sundays. The Lord's Day Act effectively permitted the provinces to pass laws which would override the Act, so in 1975, the Progressive Conservative Government of Ontario, responding to the Alliance and other Christian groups attempting to maintain a special status for Christianity, passed the Retail Business Holidays Act. It introduced a prohibition preventing most retail stores from conducting business on Sundays and on major Christian holy days, including Good Friday, Easter Sunday, and Christmas. The pretext for passing the law was that it would provide retail workers with a, quote, common day of pause, unquote, a purportedly secular purpose. However, that was a cover story. The Lord's Day Act was already providing retail workers with a common day of pause. The key difference was that under the province's Retail Business Holidays Act, a person could be charged and convicted without the requirement of first getting leave from the Attorney General. If the police found a retail store open on a Sunday or other designated Christian holy day, contrary to the Retail Business Holidays Act, they could immediately lay a charge, and with increasing frequency, they did. Several Ontario business people were offended by the law and opened their stores on prohibited days. The government crushed such people. Toronto furrier Paul Magner was fined hundreds of times for opening his store on Sundays. Ultimately, the province bankrupted him. And London bookseller Mark Emery spent 4 days in jail for opening his bookstore in contravention of the ban. Freedom Party of Ontario campaigned against the shopping ban from 1986 through 1992. All other Ontario political parties supported the Progressive Conservatives ban. However, by 1992, thanks largely to the efforts of Freedom Party, public opinion had shifted. Ontarians wanted to be free to choose whether or not to shop on Sundays. In response, Bob Rae's NDP government, which had campaigned in 1990 on making the ban even tougher, repealed the ban on Sunday shopping, but left the parts of the Retail Business Holidays Act that banned shopping on various other Christian holy days. To this day, it remains illegal to open most retail stores on such holy days as Good Friday and Easter Sunday. In 2011, Ontarians observe hundreds of religious holy days. The law does not force Ontarians to observe Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Sikh, Hindu, and other religious holy days, just Christian ones. The government should not be in the business of playing favorites with religion. Whether or not you choose to observe a religious holy day should be a matter of personal choice. A freedom government will eliminate the Progressive Conservatives' shopping ban. You will no longer be forced by law to observe any religion's holy days. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on ending forced religious observance, canceling the 2012 ban on incandescent light bulbs. In 2003, Dalton McGuinty had campaigned on closing all of Ontario's coal-powered electricity generation plants by 2007 for the purposes of improving air quality. By 2007, he was nowhere close to closing them. He could not do so because Ontario did not reliably have enough power to meet its needs, and closing the coal plants would have worsened the crisis greatly. Having failed for almost 4 years to increase the supply of electricity in the province, the McGuinty government decided to force people to consume less energy, to ration electricity. Imposing a system of rationing is not a politically popular thing to do, but people generally do not blame politicians who impose rationing if there is a, quote, need, unquote, to ration. Luckily for McGuinty, Al Gore had provided him with the alleged need he was looking for. In 2006, Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, had caused widespread panic that human industrial activity was producing enough CO2 to cause catastrophic global warming. McGuinty capitalized on that fear. Rather than telling Ontarians that he was turning to electricity rationing because he had failed to increase the supply of electricity, McGuinty told Ontarians that, quote, Ontario has to start being a responsible global citizen, unquote, and that he was working on a, quote, aggressive plan to deal with greenhouse gases, unquote. In February of 2006, radical environmentalist Matt Prescott launched a, quote, ban the bulb, unquote, campaign to encourage governments to ban the incandescent light bulb and to subsidize fluorescent light bulbs. On April 18, 2007, the McGuinty government announced that it was banning incandescent bulbs starting in 2012. That ban was released as part of a misguided, quote, flick off, unquote, campaign to discourage electricity use. Aimed at youth, the Flick Off campaign intentionally used a font designed to make the word flick look like a four-letter expletive. At the same time, the McGuinty government forked out taxpayer dollars for commercials in which TV personality David Suzuki is depicted fictionally snatching incandescent bulbs from the homes of homeowners and replacing them with fluorescent ones. Far from condemning the 2012 ban on incandescent light bulbs, the progressive conservatives wanted the ban to start sooner. Then progressive conservative leader John Tory said the progressive conservatives wanted the ban to start, quote, as soon as possible, unquote, and that the McGuinty government, quote, should get on with it, unquote. However, by that time, industrial and commercial businesses, which then consumed more than 70% of Ontario's electricity, were leaving Ontario for places like India and China, where labor costs are exceptionally lower. By 2010, Ontario's industrial sector had been gutted. The result? Ontario now has not too little electricity, but too much. The oversupply is so bad that Ontario sometimes has to pay American facilities to take our excess electricity. Fluorescent light bulbs have some advantages over incandescent bulbs. They do not give off as much heat, which is good during hot summer months. It is claimed that they last longer than incandescent light bulbs. They also require less electricity. However, fluorescent light bulbs also have some drawbacks. Some people have reported the explosion of fluorescent bulbs. Fluorescent light bulbs may contain mercury, which makes them difficult to dispose of in an environmentally sound way. Fluorescent light bulbs are not suitable for exterior use on Canada's freezing cold days of winter, of late fall, and of early spring. Some people find fluorescent light to be hard on the eyes, especially when reading. Fluorescent light bulbs do not provide the additional housewarming heat that incandescent light bulbs do for Ontario's cool or freezing days in autumn, winter, and spring. And fluorescent light bulbs are much more expensive than incandescent bulbs. Each kind of bulb has its advantages and disadvantages. Ontario now has surplus energy. There is no need to ban incandescent light bulbs. A Freedom government will scrap the 2012 ban on incandescent light bulbs. You'll be able to use whichever bulb suits your purpose and your budget. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2012 election plank on canceling the 2012 ban on incandescent bulbs. Closing Ontario's race-based public schools. Before and during the 2007 Ontario general election, the Progressive Conservative Party proposed that taxpayers be forced to fund faith-based private schools. Calling evolution a, quote, theory, unquote, they proposed that Ontario's curriculum should be changed so as to, quote, teach children that there are other theories that people have out there that are part of some Christian beliefs, unquote. Mid-election poll results indicated that one in two Ontarians believed the Progressive Conservatives' proposal would segregate the province along religious lines. Ultimately, their election loss was widely blamed on the Progressive Conservatives' unwillingness to abandon their proposal to fund private faith-based schools with taxpayer dollars. The current Progressive Conservative leader, Tim Hudak, was just as vocal as then-leader John Tory about his support for making taxpayers pay for private faith-based schools. On his website, he stated that, quote, support for parents who choose to send their children to independent faith-based schools has been a long-standing cause for me, unquote. Incidentally, the source for that quote was Tim Hudak's own website, but don't look for it because Mr. Hudak is covering his tracks. He has removed the article from his website. Hudak said that the purpose of extending taxpayer funding to religious private schools was to, quote, end discrimination against non-Catholic faith-based schools, unquote. That's from the Welland Tribune, July 27, 2007. And, even after the Progressive Conservatives lost the 2007 election, Hudak told the CBC that the Progressive Conservative Party, quote, shouldn't give up on trying to financially help families who send their children to private religious schools, unquote. That's from an article dated November 1, 2007, titled, Religious School Funding Issue Not Over, : Conservative MPP. Just days after Hudak's statements to the CBC, it was reported that the Toronto District School Board would be holding two public hearings about whether or not to open a, quote, black focus, unquote, or, quote, Afrocentric, unquote, school in Toronto. Tempers ran hot at the meetings, which featured such noteworthy speakers as Laureen Small, the mother of slain student Jordan Manners. In her view, a, quote, black school, unquote, would have the effect of segregating students according to race. As she put it, quote, this black school thing? It's wrong. Unquote. On January 29, 2008, despite the widespread public opposition to such a school, the Toronto District School Board voted to open Toronto's first, quote, Afrocentric, unquote, school. Dalton McGuinty feigned concern, but refused to take any steps to prevent the school from being opened. Tim Hudak, being in favor of taxpayer-funded religious segregation, did not oppose the opening of the race-based school. Toronto's Afrocentric Alternative Elementary School opened its doors in September of 2009. Students there are now taught in an environment infused by emphasis on race. quote, black, unquote, teachers teach, quote, black, unquote, students, quote, black, unquote, history, and other subjects through an Afrocentric lens. To infuse a school environment and curriculum with an emphasis on genetic makeup is wrong to the core. To argue that a, quote, black, unquote, child needs, quote, black role models, unquote, is to tell the child implicitly that, quote, if a black person has never done it before, black people don't do it at all, unquote. To focus on, quote, black culture, unquote, is to suggest that, quote, this is the culture that black people should have, unquote. Such an emphasis on race is racist, and it encourages children to focus on their genetic makeup instead of upon their potential and values as members of the human race. Children should not be taught that one's genetic makeup determines one's potential, values, or heroes. Ontario schools should be colorblind. Heroes and heroines, role models, should not be portrayed as heroic because of their skin color, but because of the greatness of their characters or achievements as human beings. Dalton McGuinty was wrong not to stop the opening of a race-based public school in Ontario, and Tim Hudak's apparent embrace of segregation in schools is even more worthy of contempt. A freedom government will do what neither Dalton McGuinty's Liberals nor Tim Hudak's Progressive Conservatives will do. A freedom government will permanently eliminate race-based public schools and change the law so that no school board will have the authority to open one ever again. One race, the human race. That's Freedom Party's stand. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party's 2011 election plank on closing Ontario's race-based public schools, separating public schools and organized religious practice. In recent months, Ontario has faced a number of different issues relating to religion in our public schools. Dalton McGuinty's Liberals and Tim Hudak's Progressive Conservatives have refused to get involved, even though public schools fall exclusively within the jurisdiction of the Ontario Legislature. The range of examples is broad, but includes the following. 1. Distribution of religious texts by public schools. In November of 2010, public school trustees in Waterloo voted to continue the 65-year practice of allowing public schools to distribute the Gideon's Little Red Answer Book to grade 5 students. A letter at the beginning of the book tells the student to, quote, read prayerfully, pray before you read, and afterwards, ask God to open your mind to understand His Word, ask Him to reveal you to Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, unquote. In January of 2011, it was reported that a Muslim leader in Kitchener had applied to have Waterloo's public schools distribute the Quran to grade 5 students. The distribution of the Gideon Little Red Answer Book was cited as precedent for his request. Growth in the number of religious texts that would be distributed in our public schools led to public debate. However, Liberal Premier Dalton McGuinty refused to get involved, saying, quote, I'm not going to weigh in on that, other than to say I encourage the representatives of the school board there to make sure they give this careful consideration, listen to the population, unquote. In June, the Waterloo Public School Board reversed its decision. It will no longer distribute any religious texts in Waterloo's public schools. However, the practice of distributing religious texts to grade 5 students continues in numerous other Ontario Public School Board jurisdictions. In 2010, the Gideon's Little Red Answer Book was distributed through public schools in other jurisdictions including Hamilton, Toronto, Grimsby, Newmarket, and Orangeville. 2. Religious worship in public schools. In July 2011, it was reported that at least one Ontario school board, the Toronto District School Board, has been allowing public schools in Toronto to be used as places of worship during school hours. Over the last 3 years, a weekly Islamic religious service has been held at Valley Park Middle School, a public school in Toronto, on Fridays during the school year. The service is held in the school's cafeteria after lunch, during class, for 30 to 40 minutes. A local imam comes into the school each Friday to lead the service, which involves approximately 400 students. The female students are required to pray behind the male students. A line of desks has been seen in one media photograph to separate the sexes. Menstruating girls are required to pray behind the non-menstruating girls. On July 6, 2011, Toronto imam Stephen Rockwell defended organized prayer in public schools, telling the John Oakley Show, AM 640 Toronto, that I feel that the Hindu community, the Jewish community, the Christian community owes Islam an incalculable debt for putting religion back in schools. Mr. Oakley replied, other faith groups are feeling somehow they're kept out of the equation. Why are you getting special dispensation here? Imam Rockwell, I don't think we're getting special dispensation. If the other religions are lax or slack in practicing their religious principles, or the dogma, the ethics, that is not our problem. We are simply asking, once a week, once a week. Mr. Oakley replied, well, how can the Christians assert that? That ship has sailed already. I mean, the Lord's Prayer has been taken out. Amen. Rockwell. Yes, that ship has sailed, and the Christians lost the battle to the secularists. Mr. Oakley. Oh, so what you're saying is that you're fighting the battle for all, and to reintroduce religion. It's sort of the spearhead back, reintroducing, religion, in this case, Islam, into the public school system, into the public sphere. Unquote. On July 16, 2011's episode of Global Television's Ontario Politics program, Focus Ontario, host Leslie Roberts spoke with Imam Rockwell about the issue. Imam Rockwell's responses were again illuminating. Roberts, would you like to see an Islamic religious service like the one at Valley Park Middle School in every school, yes or no? Imam Rockwell, wherever it is practical. Unquote. During the show, the panelists got rather peeved with one another and engaged in ad hominem attacks. With respect to that tone, Roberts continued, I hope that going forward, we can have a less passionate, is the word I'll use, discussion, because this is something that isn't going to go away, as co-host John Tory knows. He lived this a few years ago. Amen. Rockwell. It gets bigger. It's going to get bigger. Roberts. All right. And we'll, no doubt, talk about it again. Amen. Rockwell. The number of Muslims in this country is exploding exponentially. Unquote. Despite the fact that the seriousness of the issue is likewise growing exponentially, the Liberal government of Dalton McGuinty is taking a hands-off approach to the issue. A July 19, 2011 Canadian press report quoted Dalton McGuinty as saying, quote, I count on school boards to work in consultation with their school communities, talking to parents in particular, to strike the kinds of accommodation that they think are reasonable and supportable. So when it comes to faith matters, I have faith in the school boards, I have faith in the schools themselves, to make judgments they think are appropriate in their circumstances. 3. Teaching in Arabic. The Islamic holy book, the Quran, is written in Arabic. In Windsor, Ontario, the public school board is allowing some schools to teach students in Arabic for the first 3 years of their public school education, skirting laws requiring public school students to be taught in English or French. 4. Religious menus in public school cafeterias. The parents of Hindu children in Toronto are also expressing concern that the school refuses to serve meat that is not prepared in accordance with Islamic law, i.e. that is not halal. Many Hindus consider the consumption of halal meat to be contrary to their religious beliefs. Similar events in other provinces. In other parts of Canada, growing requests for religious accommodation foreshadow similar requests that are sure to be made in Ontario in the near future. For example, in February of 2011, the Winnipeg Free Press reported that a dozen Muslim families were demanding that their children be excused from compulsory co-ed gym and music courses in Winnipeg public elementary schools. They demanded that girls and boys have separate gym classes, even at the elementary school level. They were, quote, adamant, unquote, that they did not want their children, quote, exposed to singing or playing musical instruments, unquote, because they claimed it is, quote, not part of the cultural reality, unquote. Not limited to Toronto. Province-wide religion policy. On April 6, 2009, the McGuinty government's education minister at that time, Kathleen Wynne, issued a document titled, quote, Realizing the Promise of Diversity, Ontario's Equity and Inclusive Education Strategy, unquote. In it, Wynne wrote, quote, I believe it is critical for us to articulate an equity and inclusive education strategy for Ontario schools. Embracing diversity and moving beyond tolerance to acceptance and respect will help us reach our goal of making Ontario's education system the most inclusive in the world, unquote. By moving, quote, beyond tolerance, unquote, toward, quote, acceptance and respect, unquote, of all cultures and cultural norms, the Liberals' education minister paved the way for a mandate requiring all cultural practices to be treated as acceptable and respectable in Ontario society, even if those practices, in fact, run contrary to Ontario's respect for the ethical and political superiority of values such as democracy, individual freedom, and the equal rights of every individual independently of their sex, genetic makeup, or sexual orientation. Pursuant to the minister's strategy document, on June 24, 2009, the McGuinty government's Ministry of Education released Policy/Program Memorandum No. 119. The memorandum required all public school boards to adopt a religious accommodation policy by the beginning of the 2010 school year. Implementation of the requirements set out in the memorandum was supported by the ministry's Equity and Inclusive Education Strategy document. The Ontario Education Services Corporation is, quote, a non-profit corporation jointly owned by all school boards in Ontario, whose mission is to provide outstanding services to all boards at a reasonable cost, unquote. In March of 2010, the OESC released, quote, template documents for policy and procedural guidelines which will meet the requirements the Ministry of Education Equity and Inclusive Education Strategy 2009 to address the needs of diverse classrooms across the province, unquote. Among the documents is a template for Ontario's public school boards to use in order to have a religious accommodation policy compliant with Ontario's Human Rights Code and the Ministry of Education's Equity and Inclusive Education Strategy 2009. The template states in part, quote, board schools will make reasonable efforts to accommodate individuals' requirement for daily prayer by providing an appropriate location within the building for students and staff to participate in prayer, unquote. Quote, breakfast and lunch programs in both secondary and elementary schools will consider relevant dietary restrictions in their menu planning, unquote. Quote, board schools will reasonably accommodate students with regard to religious attire. Religious attire is not cultural dress. It is a requirement of religious observation. Religious attire that should be reasonably accommodated in board schools includes, but is not limited to, head covers, yarmulkes, turbans, Rastafarian headdress, hijabs, crucifixes, Stars of David, etc., items of ceremonial dress, unquote. Quote, the board will seek to reasonably accommodate students where there is a demonstrated conflict between a specific class or curriculum and a religious requirement or observance, unquote. In short, the issue of merging organized religious practice into our public schools is not peculiar to the Toronto District School Board, and it did not start with the Toronto District School Board. The merger of religion and public schooling that we are now seeing has been facilitated and required by the McGuinty government. The McGuinty government's Ministry of Education now requires all public school boards across the province to accommodate religion in our public schools, and the OESC has handed our school boards a religious accommodation policy to which they need merely add the name of their board and adopt the policy as their own. The policy favors the sorts of controversial and divisive religious accommodations that have sprung up in the news in recent months. Tim Hudak's Progressive Conservatives now planning to offer religious schools within the public school system. Tim Hudak's Progressive Conservatives, the official opposition in the Ontario legislature, did not oppose the Liberal government's 2009 religious accommodation mandate. In the election of 2007, Ontario's Progressive Conservatives went down to defeat because they proposed that private religious schools be given taxpayer funding. On November 1, 2007, weeks after the party's electoral defeat, the Canadian press reported that, quote, Progressive Conservative MPP Tim Hudak says his party shouldn't give up on trying to financially help families who send their children to private religious schools. Hudak, who represents Niagara West Glanbrook, said the faith-based funding policy of leader John Tory was not the best approach, unquote. Since that time, Hudak has continued to say that he looks forward to working with the Progressive Conservative Caucus on a different approach, creating choices within the already existing public school system. Although Hudak has kept that plan out of his party's election platform, and although he tries never to talk about it with the media, Hudak is on the record as wanting to change the public school system so that some of our public schools are turned into religious schools, taxpayer-funded religious schools that are part of the public school system. Specifically, during his 2009 bid for the Ontario Progressive Conservative Party leadership, conservative blogger Stephen Taylor interviewed Tim Hudak about his stand on various issues, including religion in taxpayer-funded schools. Taylor, quote, do you think Ontario went down a road when it was moving toward, at least under the Conservatives, vouchers for private schools and faith-based schools? Do you think that's a path that Ontario should not go down again, at least under the next few years? Unquote. Hudak, quote, well, you know, I've always been a supporter of parental choice in education. I believe that parents make the best choice for their children. That's why I supported, for example, the tax credit we had for independent schools. But very clearly, in the 2007 election, voters rendered a clear verdict that they didn't support the party's policy of, insert brackets, private, close brackets, faith-based school support. And as leader of the Ontario PC Party, I won't be opening that door again. It has been closed by the voters. I will look forward to working with our, just to finish Stephen, I will look forward to working with our grassroots policy process and the members of our party who are involved and the PC caucus colleagues to look for ways to innovate and create competition and choice, but within our public school system. I think that's where the debate should be focused. Unquote. In short, a Tim Hudak progressive conservative government would give parents the choice of sending their children to a religious school that is part of the public school system, funded fully by the taxpayers. In a report titled, quote, Ontario Tories on Muslim Prayer in Schools, It's Not for Politicians to Decide, unquote, progressive conservative MPP Elizabeth Whitmer told the Canadian Press that the issue of Islamic services in Ontario public schools, quote, is an issue that the Toronto Board needs to deal with, unquote. Given Hudak's stand on religion in public schools, the progressive conservatives' hands-off, do-nothing response is not surprising. The PCs are allowing school boards to pave the way to the opening of religious schools within our public school system. Freedom Party's stand, pro-democracy, anti-theocracy. Whatever the strengths or failings of our laws at present, as they relate to the issue of religious worship or religious indoctrination in our public schools, it is both wrong and dangerous to allow our public schools to be used by any religion as places of worship or religious indoctrination. Canada is a democracy, which means that we oppose any decidedly anti-democratic system, such as theocracy. Being democratic, we are committed to the belief that our government gets its authority only from the people it governs, not from anyone's God. We are committed to the idea that government serves only the people it governs, not anyone's God. We are committed to the idea that our laws are crafted by human beings who look at problems and come up with suitable responses. We do not subscribe to the view that our laws should be dictated by one religious text or another. We in the West have had access to a long and global history. We know how individuals have been treated for failing to obey God's alleged will in a theocracy. We know about the wars, the beheadings and other murders, the assaults, the imprisonments, the stonings, the tortures, and the expropriations that result from such things as being raped, being gay, dressing wrongly, being irreverent, daring to question the existence or alleged will of God, or opening one's retail store on the Sabbath day. Despite our knowledge of that history, democracy is as fragile as it is precious, because it is a belief, not a physical object. To keep the belief alive and strong over time, our government must ever conduct itself in ways that promote democracy and reject theocracy and other anti-democratic systems. To defend our belief in democracy, we limit the term of our legislators and hold elections as reminders that government is a servant of the people, not of anyone's alleged God. In contrast, when we allow our public schools to be used as places of worship, or when we extend tax funding to religious schools, we are nurturing an opposing belief that government and its property is in the service of a god. We are promoting a belief that there is nothing wrong with theocracy, that maybe we're not democratic after all, and that democracy is merely different from theocracy, not better than theocracy. And in so failing to promote and defend democracy, we are indeed legitimizing the violations of life, liberty, and property that are carried out in the name of God and religion in theocratic countries. If non-believers and holders of a wide and conflicting variety of religious beliefs are to live in peace and harmony in Ontario, democracy must be defended, promoted, and cherished. To nurture and defend our reverence for democracy, we must not allow our public schools to be used, by any religion, as places of worship or religious indoctrination. We must not allow them to accommodate religious policies or practices that run contrary to the defense and nurturing of respect for democracy and freedom. A freedom government will ensure that our public schools are places of science and reason, places where our children can learn how to think and choose rationally and independently, places that promote respect for democracy and freedom. In particular, a freedom government will prohibit the distribution in or by Ontario's public schools of religious texts or other religious materials to students. B. A freedom government will prohibit public schools from providing or designating prayer rooms or locations. To the extent that it is practical, students will be free to pray without disturbing or leaving classes. Organized religious worship, religious services, or religious outreach programs will not be permitted in public schools. C. A freedom government will require students in our public schools to be taught classes only in the official languages of Canada, English or French. Alleged, quote, pilot, unquote, projects that skirt that requirement will not be permitted. D. A freedom government will bar religious considerations from a public school or public school board's policies and procedures regarding cafeterias, food, or kitchens, while ensuring that a wide variety of healthy foods are available for consumption. E. A freedom government will prohibit religion-based exemptions of students from mandatory classes, for example, music in elementary school, and religious-based segregation of students in classes, for example, segregating boys from girls in elementary school gym. F. A freedom government will prohibit students, teachers, staff, and volunteers from wearing burqas, which are full body and face coverings, or niqabs, which are face coverings, on public school property or at public school functions. Hijabs, which are headscarves, that do not include a niqab, a face covering, will not be prohibited. G. Overall aim or umbrella provision. A freedom government will prohibit any other religious accommodation policies in our public schools that would undermine respect for democracy and freedom, or that would accommodate, promote, or normalize racism, sexism, or discrimination based upon sexual orientation. H. A freedom government will require public schools to explain that democracy is right, good, and pro-freedom, and that theocracy is wrong, bad, and anti-freedom. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on Separating Public Schools and Organized Religious Practice, Affordable Electricity. With our electricity bills soaring, Dalton McGuinty has been telling us that we must pay higher prices for new power generation. What he's not telling anyone is the real reason why. 42 consecutive years of progressive conservative rule gave Ontario extremely expensive nuclear power generators. To avoid the backlash, the progressive conservative government hid the actual cost of nuclear electricity from consumers. Billions of dollars in government debt were racked up so that electricity bills could be kept artificially low. In 1998, the Harris government passed legislation to end the irresponsible subsidy by adding a debt retirement charge to electricity bills. It also eliminated price controls on the retail price of electricity. The resulting prospect of getting a reasonable return on investment led the private sector to begin planning the construction of privately owned and operated generators that would replace Ontario's aging, government-owned fleet. However, as the election of 2003 approached, vocal opposition to higher, in other words, actual, electricity costs led Harris's progressive conservative successor, Ernie Eves, to again hide the actual cost of electricity. He imposed a 4.3-cent price cap. The remaining cost of electricity would be paid with government debt and taxes. Within a couple of weeks, Dalton McGuinty, who initially condemned Eves' new subsidy, supported it. Eves' reimposition of price controls had a massively negative impact that continues to plague Ontario to this very day. The price cap and the evidence that Liberals and Conservatives were both willing to fiddle with market prices scared the private investors away before their shovels hit the ground. With prices being subsidized, consumers had no reason to reduce their electricity consumption. The resulting blackouts and brownouts of the summer of 2003 handed the McGuinty Liberals a majority government in October of that year. At the end of that October, Dalton McGuinty largely ended the irresponsible subsidy by increasing the price cap. He explained that, in the approximately 11 months since the cap was introduced, the subsidy had already cost the taxpayer $700 million. In 2003, Ontario often had to import expensive U.S. power to meet Ontario's power demands. Yet, in the face of such a shortage, McGuinty pandered to clean air advocates by promising to close Ontario's workhorse coal-powered electricity generators by 2007. In 2005, Dalton McGuinty introduced a new irresponsible subsidy to encourage private sector investment in the construction of gas-powered electricity generators. Specifically, he offered them contracts pursuant to which they would be paid for their electricity at a rate approximately three times that paid for electricity generated by coal-powered plants. Rather than cranking up taxes to build new generators, McGuinty would crank up the cost of electricity to cover the cost of the subsidy. Even with the subsidy, it would be years before the new gas-powered plants were operational. Faced with the continuing threat of blackouts and brownouts, the McGuinty government decided to buy time by imposing limits and penalties on electricity consumption. In 2006, McGuinty's political time buying would get some help. Al Gore's junk science thriller, An Inconvenient Truth, raised fear that human CO2 production will kill us. For every politician, that fear would be the gift that keeps on giving. So long as a new tax or fee or regulation could be characterized as one needed to reduce CO2 and prevent global warming, many voters would support it. McGuinty could now introduce green fees and regulations with impunity. With global warming as his excuse, McGuinty vowed to ban incandescent light bulbs by 2012. He spent $500,000 taxpayer dollars on a, quote, flick off, unquote, power conservation campaign, which featured a logo designed intentionally to look like an expletive. He made us pay for PowerWise commercials in which David Suzuki steals incandescent light bulbs from porches and breaks into homes to steal beer fridges, all so as to convince us that such theft and coercion is necessary, not so as to cope with a politically caused power shortage, but to save the planet from an alleged catastrophe. By 2008, Ontario's high taxes, high labor costs, and potentially higher electricity costs were driving industry and commerce out of the province. The business exodus reduced power consumption more than a million light bulb snatching Suzukis could ever hope to. The dramatic reduction in demand left Ontario with more than enough electricity to meet its needs even during peak periods. The drop in demand for power had introduced a new problem, surplus baseload generation, also known as SBG. When Ontario's baseload, nuclear, coal, gas, and hydro generators, generate more electricity than is being demanded, the excess electricity must be eliminated from the grid. One option is to reduce generation, but only coal and hydro plants are capable of getting back up to speed quickly enough to manage increased demand after a few hours of low demand, and McGuinty is closing the coal plants. Another option is to export excess power to U.S. buyers at discount prices. When the U.S. will not buy discount surplus electricity, Ontario now pays the U.S. to take it. In other words, it quote-unquote sells the electricity for what is called a, quote, negative price, unquote. In 2009, the McGuinty government introduced the Green Energy Act. Echoing the misguided subsidy for gas power generators, the act introduced even larger subsidies for private companies who supplied wind and solar power to the grid. Specifically, pursuant to the, quote, feed-in tariff, also known as the FIT system, they would be paid for their electricity at rates as much as 16 times higher than the price of conventional electricity. Moreover, wind and solar power generators would be given priority. Consumers would be forced to buy up all of the expensive wind and solar power before meeting their remaining power demands with relatively inexpensive electricity from coal, gas, hydro, or nuclear generators. With artificially high prices and priority, private investors now would make a killing on otherwise money-losing solar and wind power generation. Not surprisingly, thousands of private sector companies, including many farmers located in ridings that have usually voted progressive conservative, have signed up to get their cut of the loot. Ontario's independent electricity system operator is now predicting that the additional power from wind and solar generators will make those expensive and wasteful episodes of surplus baseload generation more frequent for years to come. It is expected that, to cope with the more frequent periods of low demand and excess electricity, wind and solar power generators will be taken offline from time to time. However, consumers will still have to pay the wind and solar companies for power they do not deliver while they're offline. In a nutshell, McGuinty's Green Energy Act will leave consumers paying the U.S. even more to ditch excess electricity while simultaneously encouraging the construction of even more solar and wind power generators, whose owners will be paid not to generate electricity during the periods of excess electricity that their wind and solar generators cause. To deal with public outrage over soaring electricity prices, Dalton McGuinty now falsely implies that Ontario consumers are guilty of not paying the full cost of the electricity that they are already consuming, and that he is merely raising prices to put an end to that irresponsible practice, that he is being responsible. The inconvenient truth he thereby tries to disguise is that, for purely self-serving political reasons, his government is jacking up our electricity bills to pay for unneeded electricity that we will not consume. If we are to have an affordable and reliable supply of electricity in this province, we must learn from Ontario's political history. For electoral reasons, progressive conservative and liberal governments have imposed price controls that have scared away private investment in power generation. The result has been government debt and the payment of outrageous subsidies to the private sector. Given that history, what have Ontario's opposition progressive conservatives said they would do? Were they in power? Quote, "We would invest in nuclear power," unquote, says the PC Party's new leader, Tim Hudak. In other words, a Tim Hudak progressive conservative government would repeat the disastrous policies of previous progressive conservative governments. Hudak is essentially promising that, if Ontarians elect progressive conservatives as the replacement for Ontario's Liberal government in 2011, he will pile tens of billions of dollars of additional nuclear debt onto the tens of billions of dollars of debt we already have because of nuclear borrowing by earlier progressive conservative governments. That additional debt will result in higher taxes or a higher, quote, debt retirement charge, unquote, on our electricity bills. Clearly, Ontario cannot afford to keep the Liberals in power, but neither can it afford to hand the government over to Tim Hudak's progressive conservatives. Here's how a Freedom government will make electricity affordable again. A Freedom government will eliminate artificially high prices and electricity wastage imposed by the progressive conservative and Liberal governments over the last decade. Specifically, 1. A freedom government will repeal the Green Energy Act. 2. A freedom government will eliminate Dalton McGuinty's 2014 deadline for the closure of Ontario's existing coal-fueled electricity generators. The plants will be closed only after new baseload generation facilities are built and ready to operate. 3. A freedom government will not subsidize the building or operation of privately owned and operated power generation facilities. It will instead provide new generation investors with guarantees that the government will not jeopardize their investments by interfering with market prices or by imposing politically motivated controls on the supply of or demand for electricity. 4. A freedom government will ensure that top priority is given to supplying customers with the lowest price electricity available. 5. A freedom government will facilitate price competition and allow consumers to purchase the power they want, when they want it, at the lowest price the market will bear. 6. A freedom government will require new power generation facilities not to emit chemicals or particles that significantly harm the health of Ontarians. 7. A freedom government will remove the debt retirement charge from electricity bills. As a result, Ontarians will no longer have to pay HST on hydro debt payments. 8. A freedom government will make, quote, time of use billing, unquote, optional. You will not have to do your cooking and cleaning in the middle of the night or on weekends to make your electricity affordable. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party's 2011 election plank on affordable electricity. Let me just close with the following. We frequently hear Tim Hudak, the leader of the Progressive Conservatives, and Andrea Horvath, the leader of the NDP, tell us what the McGuinty government is doing wrong. But Mr. Hudak and Ms. Horvath are not telling anyone what they would do to fix the problems that their predecessors gave us in the first place. A person who seeks to be the premier of the province of Ontario can't just be an eraser. He or she also has to be a pencil. Ideas matter. Dalton McGuinty's government certainly deserves to be shown the door, but it is paramount at this time of crisis that he not be replaced by a person and party that would actually change nothing at all. On October 6, 2011, vote for your Freedom Party candidate. Let's get our energy bills back down where they belong. Ontario needs affordable energy, and a Freedom government will deliver it. Restoring choice in healthcare. Ontario once had a healthcare system that focused on making our sick and injured well. On October 1, 1969, Ontario's Progressive Conservative government banned that system. The Progressive Conservatives set up a tax-funded government monopoly called Medicare. Medicare has been in crisis ever since. Liberal and Progressive Conservative governments have told us, year after year, that the taxpayer has to pay more to keep the system afloat. Healthcare already consumes over 65% of all Ontario tax revenues, and it's taking over a growing percentage of the budget every year. Yet every day, we hear stories that Ontario's sick and injured are suffering, even dying, as they wait in growing lineups for dwindling healthcare rations. To find out why, consider the words of the father of Canada's Medicare system, Reverend Tommy Douglas, which he gave at a 1979 conference in Ottawa titled SOS Medicare. Even as early as 1979, Medicare was in crisis. Quote, "I am concerned, as many people are, about Medicare, not with its fundamental principles, but with the problems which we knew would arise. And those of us who talked about Medicare back in the 1940s and 50s and 60s kept reminding the public that there were two phases for Medicare. The first was to remove the financial barrier between those who provide healthcare services and those who need them. And we pointed out repeatedly that that phase was the easiest of the problems we would confront. In governmental terms, of course, it means finding revenue, it means setting up organizations, it means exercising controls over costs. But in the long term, it was the easiest problem. Phase number two would be the much more difficult one. That was to alter our delivery system so as to reduce costs and so as to place the emphasis on preventative medicine. But I think what we have to apply ourselves to now is the fact that we have not grappled seriously with the second phase. We must now move increasingly toward group practice, whether it's community clinics, cooperative clinics, clinics set up by the doctors themselves, but the need for group practice so as to make possible the practice of preventive medicine. Only in that way are we going to be able to keep the costs from becoming so excessive that the public will decide that Medicare is not in the best interests of the people of this country." Unquote. In other words, setting up a tax-funded government healthcare monopoly was expected to be easy. However, if the Medicare system was not ultimately to be rejected by the public, it would be necessary to control costs by switching the focus of healthcare. a tax-funded government monopoly could not focus on making the sick and injured well, because that focus would result in unsustainable costs and in the rejection of Medicare. So instead of focusing on making the sick and injured well, Medicare would focus on preventing the well from getting sick or injured. 42 years later, we still see Ontario's Medicare system focusing on preventive medicine. Most recently, the Liberal government of Dalton McGuinty has used taxpayer dollars to fund 220 or more group practices, including not only physicians, but a range of professionals, including, for example, social workers, whose primary focus is not making the sick and injured well, but keeping the healthy from becoming sick and injured. In our schools, the government has banned junk foods, mandated exercise, and targeted trans fats. The government has funded a growing range of vaccinations to reduce the possibility that Ontarians will become sick and become a drain on the healthcare system. The government has taken increasingly aggressive steps to ban cigarette smoking in an effort to reduce the occurrence of serious illnesses that would place even more economic pressure on the sustainability of Medicare. In short, in an effort to keep Medicare from bankrupting the province, the government has been focusing on the healthy instead of on the sick and injured. Not surprisingly, Ontarians who are not seriously sick or injured are more likely to think that Medicare is working well. They trust that, when they become sick or injured, the Medicare system will be there to help them. However, Ontario's countless sick and injured have a different view. They believe, rightly, that Medicare is failing them. Read the newspapers and listen to talk radio, and almost every day you'll hear about someone waiting months or years for a doctor, then months or years for a specialist, then months or years for diagnostic tests, then months or years for surgery or other treatments. You will read or hear of people sitting in hospital emergency waiting rooms with very serious sicknesses or injuries, suffering for hours or even days as they wait to be seen by a physician. In fact, you will read of people literally dying as they wait for service in our hospitals. There are reports of patients being placed in beds in makeshift spaces in ambulance parking lots. There are patients left in the halls of our hospitals with little or nothing to separate them from the public walking past. In London, Ontario, emergency patients wait in ambulances outside the hospital, such that there is sometimes only one vacant ambulance available for the entire city. At a major hospital like St. Michael's in Toronto, there are days of the week in which only one operating room is open, such that the entire hospital can perform only one surgery at a time. As a case in point, Freedom Party leader Paul McKeever's own brother, that's my brother, waited for days, almost dead on an IV drip, as he waited for serious emergency surgery at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. Suddenly, after a surgery for another person had been completed, a surgery that took over a day, assistants rushed into his room and transferred him to a gurney so as to rush him to the operating room. They were too slow, so nurses, knowing the life-or-death nature of the situation, rushed into his room and rolled the entire bed down to the operating room. The nurses later explained that getting into the operating room was a case of, quote, first come, first serve, unquote, so they had to rush him into the operating room before someone else was rushed into it. McKeever's brother lived. It is not known if someone else died waiting while he was being operated upon. Ask yourself, is this an example of a system that is working well for the sick and injured? A healthy lifestyle is a good personal choice. However, Freedom Party of Ontario believes that making the sick and injured well should be the top priority for Ontario's healthcare system. Accordingly, a Freedom government will restore the healthcare choices that the Progressive Conservatives banned in 1969. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on Restoring Choice in Healthcare. Safe and Convenient Access, Cannabis Medicine Centers. On July 31, 2000, Ontario's Court of Appeal held that Canada's law against the cultivation and possession of cannabis violates an individual's rights of liberty and security of the person if he is using cannabis as a medicine for an illness. The federal government was ultimately compelled by the courts to make changes to the law that would ensure that patients had access to cannabis for medical purposes. Despite the court order, the federal government has remained worried both about the electoral implications of facilitating cannabis access and about offending other countries in which it remains illegal to use cannabis even for medical purposes, especially the USA, which continues its, quote, war on drugs, unquote. As a result, the Canadian government has created a system which just barely complies with the court's order, but which does not work well. Patients find it difficult to obtain legal permissions to purchase, possess, or cultivate cannabis for their medicinal needs, and, even if patients obtain the legal permissions, the government forces them to buy poor quality cannabis from government cultivators. Other political and legal pressures put physicians at risk of losing their licenses or insurance coverage if they prescribe cannabis, which makes it difficult for individuals to obtain the prescriptions they need to prove they are exempt from the prohibition on cannabis. In short, both federal and provincial governments have failed to create the legislative framework and infrastructure necessary to ensure that patients have a safe and reliable way to obtain the cannabis medicines they need without risking fines or imprisonment. Instead, both federal and provincial governments have focused their efforts on choking off the cultivation and supply of cannabis. In 2001, the Progressive Conservative Government of Ontario introduced asset forfeiture legislation, now titled the Civil Remedies Act 2001. The legislation was introduced by Canada's current finance minister, Jim Flaherty. Freedom Party opposed the legislation because it allows the government to seize and keep a person's property even without charging him or her with an offense, and even without proving a person to be guilty of an offense. According to a 2007 report by then Liberal Attorney General Michael Bryant, quote, 13 properties, along with marijuana grow equipment and other assets linked to marijuana grow ops worth more than $500,000, have been forfeited. 52 properties associated with marijuana grow operations are currently frozen under the Act. Unquote. The source of that quote was a government document titled An Update on the Civil Remedies Act 2001. In response to the government's failures, compassion clubs, or cannabis dispensaries, have opened in numerous cities across the country to help patients obtain the cannabis medicines they need. Until recently, police have let the dispensaries operate because many sympathetic police officers understand that the sick and the dying need them. However, from time to time, police face political pressure to raid the dispensaries. Specifically, if a citizen makes a complaint, or if news media claim that the police are failing in their duties with respect to cannabis, police forces sometimes feel obliged to raid dispensaries and lay charges so as to keep up appearances and protect the public's confidence in police competence. As a result, police have advised dispensary owners to try to, quote, stay under the radar, unquote, so that public complaints do not force the police into a situation where they feel politically compelled to raid the dispensaries. Due to government dithering, delay, and outright refusals to get on with facilitating an infrastructure to provide patients with access to cannabis medicines, cannabis dispensaries currently exist in a legal gray zone. They are constantly at risk of being shut down by people who do not want cannabis to be used, even to relieve the agony of the sick and dying. Being in a legal gray zone, they are also under a higher risk of being burglarized or robbed, because thieves know that cannabis dispensary owners are not likely to report such burglaries or robberies to the police. In 2010, the Federal Conservative Government of Canada continued to ramp up its war on cannabis. It had Health Canada issue a statement on June 7, 2010, condemning cannabis dispensaries and giving police implicit orders to crack down on them. Canada's oldest dispensary, the Cannabis as Living Medicine, or CALM, dispensary in Toronto, was raided both in the spring and in the summer of 2010. In a show of force caught on videotape, patrons or employees were thrown to the floor, cuffed, and even physically beaten. Numerous other coordinated raids were conducted on dispensaries in Quebec. If the raids continue, the cannabis dispensaries may be permanently closed, leaving the sick and the dying with even less access to the medicine they need. Clearly, there is a need to remedy this situation. A Freedom government will begin the process of creating the necessary medical infrastructure in Ontario to implement the Court of Appeals Year 2000 decision in respect of the medicinal use of cannabis. Specifically, 1. A Freedom government will introduce legislative changes to make properly operated, safe, and clean cannabis centers provincially registered and recognized healthcare facilities. Police raids on such facilities will be prohibited, except where the facility management calls upon police to deal with such matters as burglaries, theft, or violent disturbance. 2. A Freedom government will introduce legislation providing that physicians who recommend the use of cannabis for medicinal treatment shall not for that reason be punished or denied any license, insurance, right, or privilege. 3. About the legality of growing, purchasing, and using cannabis for medicinal purposes, and to ensure the public that the police are upholding the law in respect of cannabis, a Freedom government will require police forces to direct all calls concerning cannabis matters to officers having the particular responsibility of ensuring that patients continue to have safe and reliable access to provincially recognized cannabis centers. All complaints concerning cannabis or cannabis centers will be forwarded to those officers, who can then explain that the police have a responsibility to defend the lives, liberty, and property of patients who use cannabis centers and of those who cultivate or produce cannabis medicines for patients. The designated officers will also respond to calls from patients and from cannabis centers in respect of such things as vandalism, burglaries, robberies, or other crimes affecting them. 4. a freedom government will amend the Civil Remedies Act 2001 to require all proceeds from the sale of property received in relation to a cannabis offense to be paid into a compassion fund to subsidize the medical and legal expenses of medical cannabis patients and providers. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 Safe and Convenient Access Cannabis Medicine Centers election plank. Alcoholic beverages, shopping convenience, wider selection, lower prices. The issues. Issue 1, the minimum price laws. At present, the law imposes minimum prices on beer, wine, and spirits. As examples, at present, a 341 milliliter bottle of beer having 5% alcohol content cannot be sold for less than $1.08, including taxes. A 750 milliliter bottle of vodka, whiskey, gin, rum, or tequila cannot be sold for less than $22.80, including taxes. A 750 milliliter bottle of liqueur cannot be sold for less than $15.35, including taxes. The law also prohibits the LCBO from purchasing wines from producers who offered at low prices. The LCBO is prohibited from buying wine that costs the LCBO less than $1.60 per 750 milliliter bottle, including taxes. The minimum price laws nullify the price-reducing effects of fair competition. The result is that consumers are needlessly forced to buy wine, beer, and spirits at artificially high prices. Issue 2. Retail monopolies. Prior to 1916, beer, wine, and spirits could be purchased at privately owned stores in Ontario. In 1916, the Conservative government imposed liquor prohibition in Ontario. In 1927, the Conservatives replaced prohibition with a government monopoly on the retail sale of alcoholic beverages. It also instituted heavy-handed regulations, including regulations banning singing and banning unmarried men from sitting with women in bars. The repeal of many of the more outrageous government activities in alcohol, such as spying and keeping lists of known drunkards, took decades. Today's Liquor Control Act and Liquor License Act retain many of their old, backward 20th century aspects. Among the worst is that the law currently continues to impose two monopolies with respect to alcoholic beverages. Under our current laws, you can buy liquor only from a government store operated by the Liquor Control Board of Ontario, the LCBO. The Government of Ontario regulates the minimum prices at which liquor and beer must be sold. Above that price, the LCBO determines the retail prices at which all liquor, wine, and beer are sold, including the beer sold in the beer store. The government also continues to give a private company, Brewers Retail, which owns and operates the beer store, a monopoly. Brewers Retail Inc. used to be owned and operated by Canadian companies Molson Breweries and Labatt's Breweries. However, those beer companies were sold to U.S. companies. Today, Brewers Retail Inc. is completely foreign-owned, yet the Ontario government continues to prevent any beer stores from opening in competition with the beer store. The result of the LCBO and Brewers Retail Inc. monopolies is there is no price competition and no competition related to what sorts of liquors, wines, or beers one can buy in Ontario. With no price competition, prices are kept artificially high. With the LCBO being the only liquor retailer, you cannot buy beers, wines, or liquors that the LCBO does not want to stock. For example, the LCBO refuses to sell Canadian actor Dan Aykroyd's premium Crystal Head vodka, made in Newfoundland, in its stores because the vodka comes in a bottle shaped like a clear crystal human skull. The LCBO also refuses to sell Smash Bomb Atomic IPA, an ale made by Flying Monkeys Craft Brewery of Barrie, Ontario. It objected to the name and label as a matter of political correctness. Our plan. 1. A freedom government will eliminate the minimum prices placed upon beer, wine, and spirits. If you choose to buy such products, you will have more money left in your pocket to purchase other things you and your family need or want. 2. A freedom government will remove the last vestiges of the Conservatives' 1927 prohibition laws by eliminating the LCBO's power to determine the price of all liquors, wines, and beers sold in the province, and ending the LCBO and Brewers Retail Inc. monopolies. If you have proof that you are 19 years of age or over, you will be able to continue buying beer at the Brewers Retail beer store, but you will also have the option of buying it at the grocery store or at another competing beer, wine, or liquor store. You will be able to continue buying liquor, wine, and beer at an LCBO government store, but you will also have the option of buying it at a privately owned, non-LCBO store. All retailers will be free to reduce prices so as to compete for your business. Competition among sellers will ensure that you are not being overcharged for any alcoholic beverages you might choose to buy. Ending the LCBO and beer store monopolies will also increase the likelihood that, if you cannot find the product that you are looking for at one store, you will be able to find it at a competitor's store. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on Alcoholic Beverages, Shopping Convenience, Wider Selection, Lower Prices, Eliminating Ontario's Beer and Wine Taxes. Until June 30, 2010, the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario imposed fees upon the manufacturers of beer and wine in the province. On July 1, 2010, the day the HST was introduced, the McGuinty government quietly took the fee burden off of manufacturers and dropped it onto the shoulders of Ontario beer, wine, and wine cooler consumers. Specifically, it eliminated the manufacturers' fees and imposed new taxes on beer, wine, and wine coolers. Progressive Conservative and Liberal governments have told Ontarians that beer, wine, and wine cooler taxes are meant to discourage alcohol abuse. The range of different taxes proves that that is not the real reason for the taxes. For example, the basic beer tax in 2010 is about $5.76 for a case of 24 beer made by the big manufacturers, but the beer tax on a case of 24 microbrewery beer is $1.72, and there is no beer tax at all on beers made outside of Ontario. As another example, Ontario wine and wine coolers are subject to a 6.1% tax, but the tax on non-Ontario wines and wine coolers is 16.1%. If the real purpose of wine and beer taxes were to discourage alcohol abuse, the tax would be the same on all beers, regardless of who brewed them, and on all wines, regardless of who produced them. In truth, wine and beer taxes are meant to serve at least two purposes. One is to give the government the power to influence which beers consumers choose to buy. By taxing some products more and some less, the government creates an unfair playing field for producers, and it does so by penalizing you, the purchaser. Wine and beer taxes are also imposed as a way to give the LCBO an artificially boosted profit. Wine and beer taxes are not charged on beer, wine, and wine coolers if they are sold by the LCBO. Yet the price of beer, wine, and wine coolers is not lower at the LCBO than it is at the beer store or at winery retail stores. That is because the LCBO quietly charges consumers an extra amount equal to the tax and records the extra amount as its own revenue. To hide that fact from consumers, the law requires the beer and wine taxes charged by the beer store and by winery-operated wine stores to be buried in the total price of beer, wine, and wine coolers rather than being shown on your receipt. Ontario beer, wine, and wine cooler drinkers already have to pay HST on the products they consume. They should not be forced to pay an additional tax designed to create unfair competition among beer and wine producers and retailers and to create phony profits for the LCBO. A Freedom government will eliminate the beer, wine, and wine cooler taxes. That will knock as much as $5.76 off the price of 24 beer. For example, a box of 24 having the price of $29.95 would drop to $24.19. A Freedom government will take as much as 16.1% off the price of a bottle of wine. For example, the price of a $15 bottle of wine would drop to as low as $12.92. And a Freedom government will remove as much as 16.1% from the price of wine coolers. For example, a U.S. sangria currently selling for $11.55 would drop to $9.95. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on Eliminating Ontario's Beer and Wine Taxes, Freedom, Justice, and Peace During International Political Meetings. The issue. The decision and the price. On December 7, 2009, Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced that the 2010 G20 conference would be held in downtown Toronto, in the financial district of a city of millions. By May 26, 2010, the estimated total cost to the taxpayer was $1.1 billion. Most of the money was allocated to security costs, including a very large police presence drawn from police forces across the region and country. However, millions were also spent on facilities that clearly were unnecessary, including a now-famous $1.2 million fake lake, built for journalists to sit in Toronto in Muskoka chairs watching a huge video screen in front of an artificial lake. The results of the decision. On the weekend of June 26, 2010, political leaders comprising the G20 met in Toronto behind an immense fenced-off area guarded by police. Automobile and pedestrian traffic was congested. Business operations were interrupted. On the Saturday, a subset, perhaps 75 to 100 people referred to as the Black Bloc, of thousands of people who had been marching peacefully in opposition to policies of the G20, broke off from the rest of the group. The Black Bloc lit police cars ablaze and vandalized storefronts. It appeared to peaceful onlookers that the police were doing little, if anything, to stop the Black Bloc from vandalizing and burning. Indeed, amateur video taken at the time shows that few, if any, police were to be found, and those who were present did nothing to stop the destruction. Many concluded that the police essentially did not do their jobs on Saturday. As a result, on Saturday evening, the police were widely being criticized in the media for having done little to stop the vandalism and arson. For example, security expert Alan Bell told CTV News Channel, quote, "When we had them all together, that's when they should have been dealt with," unquote. The result was perhaps predictable. On Sunday, things swung the other way. There was no reported Black Bloc smashing of windows and no reported burning of cars. But the police took a hard line against virtually everyone in the downtown blocks near the perimeter fence. The public was initially told that there was a new law setting out a, quote, 5-meter rule, unquote, that allowed police to search people coming within 5 meters of the fence surrounding the event. Even after the police admitted that there was no such rule, they continued to search peaceful pedestrians even when such pedestrians wanted to leave the area. In fact, police were searching people kilometers away from the G20 site without lawful authority, pretending or thinking they had such authority. A number of particularly offensive abuses occurred. A group of peaceful political protesters singing O Canada were rushed, pushed, and in some cases thrown to the ground by a line of riot police the instant they finished singing the anthem. Hundreds of people were kettled, arrested en masse, and caged for hours, in some cases for days, without adequate food, water, or proper washroom facilities. Most were not charged with any offense. 8 days after the mass arrests of people who had been guilty of no crime, Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak penned a column for the Toronto Sun. He wrote in part, quote, "I proudly stand behind the men and women of our police services that were faced with a daunting and difficult task of protecting the public against these professional vandals and hooligans." He praised the police, even though they had not properly responded during the arson and vandalism on Saturday, and even though police engaged in illegal searches and abusive mass arrests of innocent people on the Sunday. Journalists and bloggers saw through Hudak, saying his response was a swing and a miss and that Hudak had copped out. When Ontario most needed an opposition leader to demand answers from the McGuinty government and the police, Hudak instead assumed the role of cheerleader for the police. On December 7, 2010, Ontario's ombudsman issued his first report concerning the investigation of the province's role in what came to be known as the, quote, secret security regulation, unquote, a regulation issued by the government of Dalton McGuinty, not communicated to the public, that gave the police, quote, unconstitutional, unquote, sweeping new powers, a new, quote, weapon, unquote, for the police. Those who entered the vicinity of the G20 event, he said, had no idea that they were, quote, literally walking into a trap, unquote. He called it an, quote, act of public entrapment, unquote, and said McGuinty's regulation contributed to, quote, massive violations of civil rights, unquote. Liberal Community Safety Minister Jim Bradley and the province would not call for a public inquiry into the G20. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak likewise has opposed the calling of a public inquiry, claiming as his excuse that it would be too expensive. Parliamentary recommendations. In March of 2011, a federal parliamentary committee recommended, quote, that the Government of Canada undertake a nationwide consultation with the provinces and territories to select locations across the regions where permanent event and security infrastructure can be built for large-scale events, such as summits, so that these locations can be reused and to reduce the use of tax dollars on ad hoc infrastructure wherever possible. Recommendation number 2 from the document titled Issues Surrounding Security at the G8 and G20 Summits, a report of the Standing Committee on Public Safety and National Security, dated March 2011. Our plan. A freedom government will require all international political events hosted in Ontario to be held in remote locations, not in our cities. To that end, a freedom government will support recommendation number 2 of the parliamentary report. A freedom government will prohibit cities from cordoning off public roads and sidewalks for international political events and will not pledge police support for such events where it is proposed that they be held within Ontario's cities and other populated areas. Also, to ensure that in the future, Ontarians are better protected both from vandals and arsonists and from abusive or illegal police responses, a freedom government will commission an inquiry into the actions of the government and police leading up to and during the G20 event of 2010. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on freedom, justice, and peace during international political meetings. Separating prayer from government proceedings. During the 2007 election, the Progressive Conservatives proposed that taxpayers begin funding private religious schools, and they lost the election. Perhaps because of the unpopularity of the PC's disastrous proposal, on February 13, 2008, Dalton McGuinty stated that, quote, "We're much more than just Protestants and Catholics today. We have all the world's faiths represented here. If they're represented outside the legislature, I think we ought to find a way to ensure that diversity is reflected inside the legislature as well," unquote. He added, quote, "I think it's time for us to ensure that we have a prayer that better reflects our diversity," unquote. And with that proposal, he opened a can of worms. A small percentage of vocal, hardline traditionalists and religious Ontarians complained that the Lord's Prayer was no longer to be said. Folding to pressure, McGuinty ultimately decided to keep the Lord's Prayer. That decision came too late. McGuinty had let the religious genie out of the bottle. Because Ontario was not going to adopt a single, quote, "prayer that better reflects our diversity," unquote, non-Christian religions wanted their prayers to their gods said in the legislature too. Ultimately, on June 12, 2008, Liberal MPP Michael Bryant introduced a motion which passed with the support of Progressive Conservative and NDP MPPs. Dalton McGuinty was absent during the vote, but now Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak was present and voted in favor of the prayers. The government increased the number of gods who are praised by our MPPs and from whom our MPPs now officially seek guidance in making the laws that govern us. In addition to saying the Lord's Prayer, Ontario lawmakers now say an Islamic prayer in which MPPs declare to Allah, quote, "You alone we worship, and from you alone we seek help. Guide us on the straight path, the path of those whom you have given your bounties, not the path of those who deserve your anger," unquote. There is also a prayer in which MPPs beg a Hindu god, quote, "We pray that he inspire our intelligence and guide our vision and will. Take us from illusion to reality, take us from darkness to light, and from death to immortality," unquote. Our MPPs now say a prayer in which they declare the greatness of the Jewish God and ask him to bless them and provide for them, in other words, to keep them. MPPs now say a Buddhist prayer, declaring that, quote, "Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself, there's nothing to do or undo, let the entire game happen on its own," unquote. Our MPPs also say a native spirituality prayer, in which MPPs declare to the, quote, "Great Spirit," unquote, that, quote, "We are weak, we are small, we need your wisdom and your strength," unquote. Our MPPs now say a Sikh prayer, in which they declare to the Sikh God, quote, "Whatever exists is by your will, you yourself act and inspire all to act, only you yourself know," unquote. Our MPPs now say a Baha'i prayer, in which each MP declares to the Baha'i God, quote, "My God, whom I worship and adore. All are but poor and needy, and thou verily art all-possessing, the all-subduing, the all-powerful," unquote. A democracy is a society in which the origin, hence the scope, of government's authority is given to it only by the people it governs. A democratic government does not concern itself with gods, alleged afterlives, or the allegedly supernatural. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. In contrast to a democracy, a theocracy is a society in which the origin, hence the scope, of government's authority is given to it by a supernatural God. In a theocracy, the government makes laws influenced by, or dictated by, the alleged commandments or will of a God. A theocracy is a government of the people, by a God, for a God. In a theocracy, the government is accountable to a God. For decades, theocrats have declared war on freedom and democracy. Democratic governments have been overrun by theocratic ones throughout Africa and Asia, using both violent and nonviolent means. Europe is now contending with advocates of theocracy, who use legal and non-legal means to instill terror, to quash dissent, and to work toward the toppling of democracy. And we must be mindful of the fact that, in the name of freedom and democracy, Canadian soldiers have died fighting theocrats in foreign lands so that theocracy does not find its way to Canada. Theocracy starts with small, politically correct concessions or accommodations by government. Theocracy is not yet encroaching on Ontario life as much as in Africa, Asia, and Europe, but recent attempts to accommodate religious legal systems like Sharia and recent attempts to silence Canadians who exercise their freedom to say things that some religious people might find insulting or offensive, demand that Ontario take necessary precautions to defend the democratic nature of our governance. If democracy is to be maintained in Ontario, we cannot continue to have MPPs we elect declaring, as an official statement by government officials, that they are wedded to a number of different gods, that obeying the wills of those various gods is their highest purpose, that a god is sovereign in Ontario, etc. If there is to be any statement at all at the beginning of Ontario's legislative proceedings each day, it should be a declaration by MPPs that they have no power or authority except that delegated to them by the people, that they recognize themselves to be servants only of individuals living in Ontario, and that nobody, not even an MPP, is above the law. The Ontario legislature is not a church or synagogue or mosque. It is not a house of anyone's god. It is not a place where a god's commandments or wishes are to be put into Ontario law. To make it clear that Ontario is and will remain a democratic society, not a theocratic one, a freedom government will ensure that prayers are no longer part of the official proceedings of the legislature. MPPs who believe in one or more gods are and will continue to be free to pray to them and to request guidance from them as a personal matter. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on prayer in the legislature. I would just add that on June 12, 2008, in the Ontario legislature, representatives of the Liberal Party, the Progressive Conservative Party, and the NDP Party each made statements that should concern all of us. They were debating at the time the motion to bring more prayers into the legislature. Then Liberal MP Michael Bryant stated, quote, "One religion cannot be preferred over another," unquote. That was somehow used to be the basis of a decision that more prayers, rather than none, should be said in the Ontario legislature. Speaking for the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario, MPP Garfield Dunlop said, quote, "A second rotational prayer reflecting multi-denominational faiths would be something that we would clearly accept. We believe very strongly that the Lord's Prayer is part of that Christianity is part of the very foundation of our wonderful country, and we want to retain that." Now you know who was responsible for bringing more prayers into the legislature. But possibly the most offensive statement was made by Reverend Sherry DeNovo, MPP for the New Democratic Party. She said, quote, "Those who don't want to pray should leave the chamber," meaning the legislature, while other MPPs say prayers there. Finally, I'll just quote to you the essential part of Hansard, the record of the Ontario legislature, which covers the vote that was made on June 12, 2008. The Speaker of the House, the Honorable Steve Peters, stated, quote, "Mr. Bryant has moved that the Speaker commence each meeting day of the Assembly by reciting the Lord's Prayer, followed by another prayer, or the presentation of a verse or passage, or call for a moment of silent reflection, or any such other similar activity which, in the opinion of the Speaker, will serve to reflect over time the general demographic composition of this chamber and of the province of Ontario. Call in the members. This will be a 5-minute bell." The division bells rang from 1323 to 1328. The Speaker said, "All those in favor of the motion will rise at a time and be recorded by the clerk." The list of people approving the motion were Sophia Agalonidis, Laura Albanese, Ted Arnott, Wayne Arthurs, Bass Balcassoon, Christopher Bentley, Margaret Best, James Bradley, Laurel Broughton, Michael Bryant, Donna Cansfield, Ted Shedley, Mike Cole, Kim Crater, Bob Delaney, Joe Dixon, Sherry DeNovo, Leona Dombrowski, Brad Duguid, Garfield Dunlop, Christine Elliott, Kevin Daniel Flynn, Peter Fonseca, Ernie Hardman, Tim Hudak, now the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, Helena Jasek, Linda Jeffrey, Sylvia Jones, Frank Cleese, Kuldip Kular, Monty Quinter, Jeff Leal, Dave Levac, Lisa McLeod, Rosario Marchese, Ted McMeekin, Madeline Meyer, Norm Miller, Reza Maridi, Jerry Phillips, Michael Prue, Shafiq Quadri, Khalil Ramal, David Ramsey, Robert W. Runciman, Liz Sandals, Joyce Saveline, Laurie Scott, Peter Sherman, Monique Smith, George Smitherman, Charles Souza, Harinda Takar, Maria Van Bommel, Jim Wilson, Elizabeth Whitmer, Kathleen Wynne, and David Zimmer. The Speaker said, "All those opposed?" And the clerk of the assembly replied, "The ayes are 58, the nays are 0. The speaker replied, "I declare the motion carried." Scrapping the $2.9 billion per year health premium and eliminating the $3 billion HST tax grab. In 2003, Dalton McGuinty and his Liberal Party campaigned on the promise that a Liberal government would not increase taxes at all. Shortly after the voters trusted him with a majority government, Dalton McGuinty announced that his Liberal government would be imposing a health premium to pretend that he was not breaking his promise. He refused to call it a tax. According to the 2010-2011 Ontario budget, the health premium is expected to continue bringing in annual revenues of approximately $2.9 billion. In 2007, the voters trusted that Dalton McGuinty would not again violate their trust with respect to taxes. After being trusted with another majority government, McGuinty announced that his government would replace the GST and the provincial sales tax on goods with a 13% harmonized sales tax, or HST, on both goods and services. He told Ontario that the switch would be, quote, revenue neutral. In other words, he told Ontario that the HST would not give the government more of your money. That was another lie. Just a short while before the July 1, 2010 launch of the HST, Dalton McGuinty admitted that, contrary to what he told us when introducing the HST legislation, the HST would actually take more of your money than the GST and PST combined. According to the 2010-2011 Ontario budget, the switch from the GST and PST to the HST is expected to take an additional $3 billion from the pockets of Ontarians every year. Dalton McGuinty's imposition of the health premium constituted a broken promise. The $3 billion HST tax grab was another broken promise. It fueled widespread taxpayer outrage because Dalton McGuinty had lied to us all again. A Freedom government will make things right. We will eliminate the $3 billion HST tax grab almost entirely by eliminating the $2.9 billion health premium. Scrapping the health premium will make the HST almost revenue neutral. The remaining $0.1 billion difference will be eliminated with small reductions of income taxes. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party's 2011 election plank on scrapping the $2.9 billion health premium and eliminating the $3 billion HST tax grab. Eliminating Ontario's gasoline tax. On July 1, 2010, Dalton McGuinty introduced the Harmonized Sales Tax, or HST, which combined Ontario's PST, 8%, with the GST, 5%. The result was a 13% sales tax. Like the GST, the HST is charged on gasoline purchases. Therefore, on July 1, 2010, Ontario started collecting an 8% tax on gasoline purchases. When it comes to gasoline, the HST is effectively a surtax. Specifically, the HST is charged not only on the price of gasoline, but also upon the 14.7 cents per liter provincial gasoline tax. Gasoline is one of the most highly taxed items in Ontario. Consider the following example to see just how taxed it is. At the time of writing, the price of gasoline, including taxes, is approximately $1.20 per liter. At that price, the price to fill a 60-liter tank is $72. Of that $72, approximately $8.28 is HST, $8.82 is Ontario's gasoline tax, $6 is federal excise tax, and approximately $48.90 is the actual price of the gasoline before taxes. Therefore, the effective tax rate on that $48.90 worth of gasoline is approximately 47.2%. As the total price of gasoline drops, the effective tax rate increases. For example, if the total price per liter were $1 instead of $1.20, the effective tax rate would be approximately 56.7% instead of 47.2%. If the total price of gasoline were to drop to 80 cents per liter, the effective tax rate would rise to approximately 73.5%. At 64 cents per liter, the effective tax rate would be approximately 100%. Despite being such a punitive tax, Ontario's gasoline tax brings in only a very small fraction of Ontario's revenues. According to Ontario's 2010-2011 budget, total revenues in 2010 were an estimated $106.9 billion. Ontario's gasoline tax was estimated to bring in revenues of $2.4 billion, only 2.2% of total Ontario revenue. A Freedom government will eliminate Ontario's 14.7 cent per liter gasoline tax. That will drop gasoline prices by 16.6 cents at the pump. It will also allow the government to entirely eliminate the cost of administering the gasoline tax. The Ministry of Revenue currently costs taxpayers approximately $1 billion per year. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on eliminating Ontario's gasoline tax. restoring fair auto insurance. The no-fault auto insurance system that we have had in Ontario since 1990 was originally conceived of in the USA in the 1930s. It was modeled upon workers' compensation schemes. The no-fault scheme is an attempt to reduce insurance payouts by preventing injured people, in most cases, from suing the drivers who caused their injuries. In short, no-fault insurance is actually no-lawsuit insurance. The history of the no-fault system in Ontario. By the time no-fault was introduced to Ontario, the pros and cons of it were becoming well known. In 1989, before Ontario adopted no-fault, a report of the Ontario Automobile Insurance Board stated, quote, "It is extremely important that the government be aware that any cost savings forecast by this report arise almost entirely from a reduction in benefits payable to injured claimants, rather than to any increase in efficiency." And, quote, "Any percentage savings due to the introduction of no-fault are one-time savings only. In short, the potential no-fault associated price reductions will not be permanent." In other words, in 1989, the Liberal government of Ontario already knew that no-fault would only give temporary relief to drivers, and that the relief would be achieved only by cutting benefits to injured persons. In 1990, the Liberals forced Ontario drivers into the no-fault system, despite what they knew. Under the no-fault system, injured persons in Ontario have received less compensation than they would have had they been allowed simply to sue the at-fault driver. Between 1990 and 1994, benefits under Ontario's no-fault system were reduced by 47.7% on average. In 1991, the Insurance Bureau of Canada reported that during the first year following the implementation of the no-fault scheme in Ontario, cuts to benefits gave the insurance industry an increase in profits of $750 million. Cutting benefits did not result in an appreciable decrease in premiums. Insurance companies did not pass the $750 million along to drivers in the form of lower premiums. No-fault has not stopped premiums from climbing dramatically. In September of 2010, Ontario drivers were again facing skyrocketing premiums. In response, the Liberal government of Dalton McGuinty attempted to minimize premium increases by cutting several key statutory accident benefits to injured people in half, from $100,000 down to $50,000. The Liberals also changed the system so that thousands of dollars in assessment costs associated with proving an entitlement to benefits are now to be paid for out of the injured person's accident benefits. Prior to the September 2010 changes, insurance companies paid for those assessments. That means that after paying for assessments, an injured person's maximum benefit is substantially less than $50,000. The McGuinty government's changes have been great for insurance companies who want to increase their profits. However, they have dealt a blow to injured drivers. We are now in a situation where Ontario drivers are forced to pay much more money for less insurance coverage than ever before. Other cons of the no-fault system. Under the no-fault scheme, compensation for pain and suffering has been, for the most part, eliminated. Unlike the tort-based system that we had prior to 1990, nobody except the most severely injured now receives pain and suffering compensation under the no-fault system. Prior to the introduction of the no-fault system, only the person who was at fault would make a claim, so only the at-fault driver's insurance premiums were increased as a result of an accident. However, under Ontario's no-fault scheme, both drivers are required to make a claim, even if the accident is entirely the fault of only one of the drivers. The result? Under the no-fault scheme, the insurance premiums of both drivers are typically increased. The experience in other jurisdictions. The experience with no-fault auto insurance has been equally bad in the other jurisdictions in which it has been tried. Manitobans suffered a 6.1% increase in their insurance premiums in 1996 after switching to no-fault. Previously, they had been told that an overall decrease of $50 million was anticipated. Having imposed no-fault in 1995, Saskatchewan drivers were finally permitted to opt out of no-fault starting January 1, 2003. The experience of drivers in no-fault states in the USA has been similar. At the peak of the no-fault trend in the USA, approximately 24 states had moved to a no-fault system. Only 12 states remain on the no-fault system today. In 1997, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners found that no-fault states had the highest average automobile liability insurance premiums. For each year between 1989 and 1995, a majority of the 10 states with the highest average auto insurance premiums were no-fault states. Between 1989 and 1995, premiums in mandatory no-fault states rose nearly 25% greater than in non-no-fault states. average 1996 profits on auto liability insurance were 7.3% in no-fault states and 5.4% in tort law states. The no-fault system failed to create fair prices for auto insurance in the United States. As in Ontario, premiums increased even though benefits were reduced. Ontario's government must learn not only from the failed no-fault experiments in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and the USA, but also from the current and obvious failure of the Ontario experiment with no-fault insurance. Every person who is injured should have the right to access the justice system so as to receive compensation pursuant to the common law for those losses that can be proven to have been caused by a driver. Only a person who has caused an accident should suffer an increase in his or her auto insurance premiums. Whether and under what circumstances pain and suffering benefits will be covered is a decision that is properly made between insurers and their clients when clients decide whether or not to buy an insurer's policy. The right solution: restore the full tort system. A Freedom government will repeal the no-fault system and return Ontario to a tort-based system in which only the at-fault driver pays. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on Restoring Fair Auto Insurance, Restoring Sensible Highway Speed Limits. In 1973-74, Arab oil-producing countries attempted to change the foreign policy of numerous other countries with respect to their position on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Oil-producing nations dramatically increased the price of oil to pro-Israeli countries and reduced oil production. In response, the USA and other countries introduced measures to ration gasoline. Given the state of technology in the vehicles used in 1974, it was believed that reducing the speed at which vehicles traveled would result in less fuel consumption. So, in 1974, as one of the several measures taken to ration gasoline, U.S. President Richard Nixon introduced an emergency maximum U.S. speed limit of 55 miles per hour. The U.S. pressured Canada to follow suit. On February 1, 1976, Ontario's Progressive Conservatives obliged. They reduced the speed limit on Ontario's 400 series highways from 70 miles per hour, approximately 113 kilometers per hour, down to 60 miles per hour, which was later switched to 100 kilometers per hour when the metric system was introduced. Today's reality demonstrates that reducing the speed limit did not cause people to slow down. To this very day, on long stretches of 400 series highways, the traffic normally moves along at approximately 120 kilometers per hour. The real effect of decreasing speed limits was to increase government revenues. Within a month after the speed limit was reduced, the Toronto Star reported that the number of speeding tickets issued by police had jumped by 45%. A population used to driving 113 kilometers per hour or more were suddenly considered traffic violators for doing exactly what they had done lawfully one day prior. In effect, Ontario drivers began being fined not for driving dangerously, but for undermining a governmental effort to ration gasoline, for undermining a governmental effort to cope with an Arab bid to turn Western foreign policy against Israel. The Arab oil-producing countries eventually discovered that their bid to change Western foreign policy using the oil weapon had failed. On November 28, 1995, the U.S. National Emergency Speed Limit legislation was repealed. As a result, speed limits on many U.S. highways were raised to their original values. Meanwhile, in Ontario, the old Progressive Conservative speed limit remains in place at 100 kilometers per hour. A Freedom government will change the speed limit to 120 kilometers per hour on Ontario's 400 series highways. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's Restore Sensible Highway Speed Limits election plank. Secure, private, convenient voting. The percentage of eligible voters who actually get out to a polling station to vote has been declining election after election. There are a number of reasons. One reason is that voting takes time. Most of us are working or studying long hours every day. We are facing crushing deadlines. We are commuting in traffic jams. Some of us are taking our children to soccer or hockey, to swimming or martial arts lessons, to piano or guitar lessons. Some of us are helping our children with their homework. We are cooking, cleaning, and paying the bills. We are collapsing with exhaustion after a long day of getting everything done. For most of us, figuring out where to vote, knowing what ID to bring, and figuring out who we can vote for requires even more work and time and requires us to break our usual routines. Another reason is that nothing ever seems to change. For decades, the reins of power have been passed back and forth between the Liberals and the Progressive Conservatives, with the exception of a one-time blip in the early 90s that gave the NDP a win. The pendulum swings back and forth between the two parties, but replacing one party with another never results in any significant change in government. hundreds of thousands of voters vote for other parties, only to feel that voting was pointless because the Liberal, Progressive Conservative, or NDP candidate won. Again. One of the most widely held misconceptions is that Liberals and Progressive Conservatives win because of their ideas or their election platforms. The reality is that, generally, Liberals and Progressive Conservatives spend their election time trashing their opponents and saying very little at all about what they would do were they to form a government. Why then do they win elections, election after election? One of the biggest factors is their ability to, quote, get out the vote, unquote. The reality is that most people who are eligible to vote are much more likely to go to a polling station and vote if someone is calling them on the telephone or knocking on their door and reminding and encouraging them to get out and vote. Unlike most political parties, the Liberals, Progressive Conservatives, and NDP have thousands of workers who work on election day to make those calls and even to drive people to polling stations. When armies of Liberals are reminding and encouraging Liberal voters to get out and vote, when armies of Progressive Conservatives are reminding and encouraging Progressive Conservative voters to get out and vote, Liberals and Progressive Conservatives can greatly increase their vote count in ways that smaller parties cannot, due to having far fewer phone callers and door knockers. In fact, successive Liberal and Progressive Conservative governments have drafted election laws in ways that foster and protect their advantage. In the years and months leading up to an election, the Liberal Party uses its army of workers to ask voters whether or not they are likely to vote Liberal. Progressive Conservatives and NDP have their workers do the same. Those parties each end up with a list of voters who are likely to vote for their respective candidates. At election time, those are the people who will receive repeated telephone calls and door knockings until they vote. How, you might ask, does a party know that a person on its list has voted? If you have voted before, you will remember that when you attend a polling station, you tell the election staffer your name. He or she finds your name on a list of voters and strikes your name off the list to indicate that you have come in to receive your ballot and vote. Liberals and Progressive Conservatives have passed election laws that give their party workers the right, throughout the duration of the voting day, to see who has voted and who has not. As names are struck off the list of electors at the polling station, the Liberals and Conservatives strike those names off of their internal party lists of people who are likely to vote for their party. In other words, the privacy of voters is violated so that Liberal, Progressive Conservative, and NDP armies can focus their efforts on people who have not yet voted and who are likely to vote for their respective parties. As life gets ever busier, the Liberal, Progressive Conservative, and NDP advantage, targeting their supporters and encouraging them to get out and vote, works increasingly in favor of those three parties. Elections become more and more focused not on ideas, but on the size of their respective workforces, which gives a party a much greater ability to get its own voters out to the polls. Ontario faces a large number of serious crises. The quality of a party's ideas must matter if it is to be trusted with forming a government. Ontario voters deserve better than an election determined mainly by how many worker bees each party has at its disposal. Voters who do not want to vote for Liberal, Progressive Conservative, or NDP candidates need voting to be made easier, less time-consuming, and more convenient. A Freedom government will introduce changes to level the election playing field, improve voter privacy, and make voting easier, less time-consuming, and more convenient. Specifically, 1. A Freedom government will issue a voter card, including a photo, voter number, and personal identification number to every eligible voter. The voter card will ensure that your name does not get left off the list of eligible voters. If you attend a voting station to vote in person, your possession of the card and the photo will serve as sufficient identification to prove your identity and your eligibility to vote in person. The voter card will minimize the likelihood of in-person voter fraud. Moreover, by moving to a voter card system, the Ontario government will eliminate the current wasteful expense of constantly tracking people down and making voter lists current. 2. A Freedom government will introduce telephone voting and online voting. Using your voter ID number and your PIN, you'll be able to cast your vote while commuting to or from school or work, while you are with your children at an evening activity such as sports or music lessons or swimming lessons, while you are visiting with your parents, while you are studying in a library, even while you are out for dinner with friends or family. In short, no matter where you are or what you are doing, you will have the time and ability to take a few seconds to vote. 3. A Freedom government will eliminate the right of political parties to monitor Elections Ontario records concerning who has voted and who has not. Whether or not you vote, no political party will know unless you choose to tell them. Your privacy will be improved and restored. Together, these changes will reduce or eliminate the advantages that taxpayer-funded political parties, the Liberals, the Progressive Conservatives, and the NDP, have over other registered political parties. The quality of a party's ideas and candidates will play a more important role.
the size of a party's army of election foot soldiers will play a much smaller role. The electoral playing field will be more level. Voters will have greater reason to hope that change will actually occur. People who have difficulty getting out to a polling station to vote will have easy, quick, and convenient methods of casting their ballot. How you vote and whether you vote will be kept a more private matter, as it should be.
That concludes the reading of Freedom Party's 2011 election plank on secure, private, and convenient voting, electing Ontario's Senate nominees. Under Canada's Constitution, Canada's Parliament consists of two houses, the House of Commons and the Senate. Members, MPs, are elected to the House of Commons. In contrast, senators are appointed by the Governor General. Senators are appointed to represent one of four regions, Ontario, Quebec, the Maritime Provinces, or the Western Provinces. One main purpose of the Senate, a house of, quote, sober second thought, unquote, is to help ensure that the legislative aims or concerns of some regions of Canada do not ignore the aims or concerns of other regions. 24 of the Senate's 105 seats are constitutionally allocated to the province of Ontario. When one of those 24 seats becomes vacant, another Canadian resident of Ontario is appointed to fill the vacancy. Pursuant to constitutional convention, the federal cabinet, in practice the prime minister, chooses a person to fill the vacancy and advises the governor general to appoint that person to the Senate. The governor general then appoints the person chosen by the prime minister. The Constitution does not tell the Prime Minister how to choose a person for appointment to the Senate. The Prime Minister is in practice free to ignore anyone else's opinions on the matter. However, the Prime Minister is also free to exercise his discretion in accordance with the opinions or desires of others. Given that Prime Ministerial discretion, the province of Alberta has passed a Senatorial Selection Act. Pursuant to that act, Alberta voters vote to nominate Albertans to replace vacancies among the six Senate seats allocated to Alberta. Alberta voters ultimately have chosen two of their senators to date, Stan Waters and Bert Brown. Freedom Party believes that if Canada is going to have a Senate, Ontario's senators likewise should be nominated by Ontario voters. Accordingly, a Freedom government will introduce legislation that gives you the power to nominate Ontario individuals for appointment to the Senate in Ottawa. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election plank on electing Ontario's Senate nominees. That concludes the reading of Freedom Party of Ontario's 2011 election platform. I'm Paul McKeever. Thank you for your time. To learn more about Freedom Party, visit our website, www.freedomparty.on.ca.